In 1981, Muhammad Ali saved a man from committing suicide. For about 35 years, that's been the reporting. End of story. But after 3 years of talking to eyewitnesses, the LAPD, biographers, and a lone photographer, I think the chapter on this epic Ali miracle is just beginning.
Everybody, Dwayne Johnson here to tell you about a new documentary podcast series titled What Really Happened, narrated by award-winning documentary filmmaker Andrew Jenks in coordination with our company, 7 Bucks Productions.
Ali talked Joseph down, but is there more to it? Was Joseph in on it? Was Ali showing the world that he could still talk, much less box? Why did Ali's people say Joseph was a Vietnam vet when in fact he wasn't? Go to Apple Podcasts or wherever you download your shows to listen to What Really Happened. Available now.
Hello and welcome back to another episode of Open Floor. I'm Andrew Sharp and on the other line, Ben Golliver. What's up, man?
Not too much, Andrew. I spent some time today thinking about the concept of cost of living. And I promise, before you start to freak out and wail and tell everyone what time it is, I promise I have a point here, okay? Most of our amazing members of Open Floor Globe are aware of the idea of cost of living, where, you know, you move from a small city to a big market, it gets a lot more expensive, your whole life changes. Mm-hmm. You can know about this idea, right? Like, I moved from Portland to LA. I did the little spreadsheet calculations. You know, you see how much your rent's going to be. You can zoom in by zip code. You can see how much your grocery bill is going to be. You can do all these things. They've got converters on the internet that will tell you exactly how much your paycheck's going to go towards things maybe you didn't expect. But until you actually go through it, you don't really understand the concept, right? Like, you don't really realize that, well, you might be lined up for 4 blocks on a New York City street corner waiting for a free scoop of ice cream because, like, that's the only treat you're going to get that way.
Yeah, absolutely.
And this applies for everyone. I mean, you could study Sex and the City. You know, you could be like someone who's just all in on their lifestyle. Think you know, but until you go through it, you don't really know. And the reason why I bring this up is because I have been reading our emails at openfloormail@gmail.com. And I'm starting to see a similar pattern here where people understood things intellectually, but until they saw it, until they actually went through it, they didn't get it. And I'm talking about the Cleveland Cavaliers, Andrew, because we prepared people, okay? We prepared people. We were that spreadsheet, you know? We said, it's going to get rocky. It's going to be tough. There's going to be hard times. LeBron's the only ball handler they've got. They're pretty old. They're piecing together the rotation. They brought in Dwayne Wade to be his buddy, not to really be a sidekick. They're changing all these different people's positions, their different roles. We did our best to, you know, intellectually prepare people for the Cleveland Cavaliers experience. And yet, what did we see in our emails, Andrew, all weekend? People freaking out about how the Cavaliers look in the first 10 games.
Hold on. I think you're being a little disingenuous here. Because, yes, we were all prepared for a bit of a rocky adjustment in Cleveland. I don't think anyone would have expected a Cavs team that was going to blow games to the Knicks. They almost lost to the Bulls the other night.
But why not, Andrew? Why not? Really? Why not?
A lot of reasons. I mean, come on. Like, don't play dumb here. Like, they have LeBron James. The rest of the league is pretty watered down right now. Nobody was expecting them to come out and be sub-500.
Well, it's happened many times over the course of LeBron's career where they've gotten off to slow starts. We knew he was going to have
not
to play
like this.
Heavy minutes.
Don't
yes,
pretend that
like
this is
this. Andrew, they were 19-20 the first year he came back to Cleveland. This is still, we're not in November yet.
I really enjoyed your little cost of living soliloquy there. I'm curious as to some of the other things you use Excel for in life and different ways that you break down just the world around us with spreadsheets. And yeah, as far as the Cavs, it's a more complicated conversation. So let's just jump in to the emails right away here. This is from Jake. He says, what the hell is wrong with Cleveland? I know they'll probably work it out barring injury, but losing to teams like Brooklyn, Orlando, and New York is total bullshit. So That's a fair point. And that's what I was saying, is that like this is a degree of struggle that I don't think anyone expected. And I do think that there's some cause for alarm here that goes beyond the typical Cavs melodrama. And it's funny because I thought about mentioning the Cavs on Friday and congratulating us for not falling for their trap and freaking out, because the Warriors have also been losing, and I think everyone around the league kind of was willing to shrug it off. But it's funny how a loss to the Knicks changes everything. And now I think we need to at least talk about what's going on.
I got it. Okay, so they lose the Knicks, and now you're going to fall into a trap that
Well, do you think it's a trap, though? Let's start there. Do you think this is a trap?
I want to draw a distinction between looking at how they're playing here in the first week and the gradation of how bad that is versus what does it mean bigger picture, right? Because I think if you look solely at the beginning of the season, I'm not surprised in the slightest. I don't know how much more we could have done to get people to realize that, yeah, this could definitely happen. I mean, LeBron's playing 37 minutes a night. They don't have the depth. They don't feel comfortable taking him off the court. That means they're not going to be good defensively until down the stretch of the season. I mean, everyone who wants to, like, you know, gif their defensive breakdowns in October, it's sort of like self-evident. You know, we already know that that was going to happen. I mean, this is how it's been for a long time. I think until they have Isaiah back, you can't truly judge the ceiling of this team. Now, at the same time, I do think that there are some things that we could take away from this, not necessarily panic-related, but conclusions that we can draw that are sort of negative conclusions, big picture. Number one, regardless of whether they've been playing bad or whether you're going to allow all their guys who are kind of underperforming to sort of be their best selves, is this a team you can see in any way hanging with Golden State in the finals? Like, even in their best case scenario, Isaiah comes back, Jay Crowder balls, Wade plays well. I mean, is this a team that's ready to compete for a title? Yes or no? To me, the answer is no. I don't see any way they can
definitely not. And I don't think that's even a useful discussion, because they, like a month ago, even again, like even the people who bought in on this team all the way didn't think that they were really going to go beat the Warriors. But I do think that the above the line, below the line standard is going to be the finals. Like, is this a team that's going to make it out of the East and go to the finals? And they're
standard. I know, but that's an important standard for them, right? Because LeBron always wants to win a title, and because LeBron's a free agent. So that is a standard that we have to look at. And if we're saying after 2 weeks, we now have the evidence, you know, we're now in our cost of living, like, we're living it. We're here. We're seeing it, right?
Life is getting real. Dwayne Wade is playing 30 minutes a game next to Jeff Green.
Yeah, and that is a bad formula, and that's not going to be good enough to go against Golden State. So that's one takeaway I think we can make safely without being accused of panicking, right? Uh-huh. I don't think that's a panic. That's not hammering them for their October play. Here's my second takeaway, and tell me if you're with me on this one, because it might be a little bit more of a reach. Viscerally, they are even more depressing than I kind of feared they might be.
Yeah.
They're even less entertaining. They're less cool. They're less trendy. They're less everything. And again, if I'm looking at sort of the best case scenario for bouncing back, so we're saying, okay, we're going to cut D Rose out of the rotation at some point, right? We're going to limit Dwayne Wade's role. We're going to pray that J.R. Smith gets his game together. We're going to hope that Tristan Thompson can get back to, you know, previous like finals level Tristan Thompson. Even in that scenario, if we're bored from the outside by it, you know, or if we don't view that as sort of the cutting edge of the NBA or the newest, coolest thing, what does LeBron think in the middle of it, right? And he's been very careful not to kind of slam anyone. I think he's trying to keep that upbeat tone that he brought to Media Day, which I think was completely the right message for this group, given all the changes and so forth. Is this going to get boring to him, right? And what does that mean for their future? If I'm him, I'm bored. I'm not engaged. Yeah. I'm not excited. This isn't cool. It's fun to hang out with D-Wade and drink the wine on Instagram. That's the fun part of life, right? That's the cool, entertaining part. not what's happening on the court. And I think that's a huge problem for the Cavaliers. I give Kobe Altman all the credit in the world for what he did this summer. I think he had an incredible summer. That doesn't mean he made a cool kind of like cutting edge team. And I think that means after a couple weeks here, I am more convinced than ever LeBron's gone. There's just not any way to turn this into the center of the NBA universe in Cleveland for next season. I think he's gone.
That is a very fair point, because I think if you're selling me on LeBron leaving Cleveland, where I've kind of gone back and forth over the last year or so in terms of how realistic that is. But I think if he were going to leave, the reason he'd go somewhere is because, look, if all roads lead to the Warriors regardless, at least it's interesting to sort of switch up the scenery and add a new chapter to the narrative, as opposed to just staying in Cleveland as the team around him gets older and shittier every year and like a little bit more depressing. That's the reason I could see him leaving. What, it's not because he's going to go create some sort of like super team, like Avengers squad that takes down the Warriors, but it may make sense for him to just sort of start a new chapter somewhere else, just from a marketing standpoint, a lot of different things that and a legacy standpoint, all sorts of different things that LeBron cares about. Leaving might be a good option.
We knew a couple years ago he got a little jealous of the Warriors' attention, right? Like he started kind of putting himself into stories. There's not going to be any scenario where he goes into next year as not being a top three or four story, right? And if he stays in Cleveland, I don't see them being that top three or four story heading into next season. And so I think one other theory I want to throw by you is we've seen over the last 6 months the serious compromises of the banana boat squad. You look at Chris, he couldn't have it all, right? He couldn't stay in LA. He couldn't have that big market. He couldn't get the max contract and compete for a title. So he had to make a choice. He chose to go be number two in Houston with James Harden. You look at Carmelo Anthony, he couldn't have it all. He couldn't use that leverage that he had to get to one of these top shelf organizations that he wanted to be to. So he goes and settles, quote unquote, settles for a small market in Oklahoma City. I'm sure deep in his heart, Carmelo viewed that as sort of like a serious compromise. I'm sure
he did. Definitely.
I mean, Manhattan didn't see himself at the Cracker Barrel.
He's looking around at the Boot Barn and the Ghost Hotel and saying, man, I've put it all my chips are on the table here.
Yeah, and then you look at Dwayne Wade, same thing. I mean, he got paid by Chicago. I mean, that was a fleecing of Gar Foreman. Well, he had to compromise. Now you look at his role in Cleveland. He gets to play with LeBron. Maybe he's not playing starters minutes. There's a compromise. LeBron is not going to be in a situation next summer where he is going to be able to have it all. I don't think he could have that hometown hero vibe and competing for a title and being on this cool, awesome, talked about team and being the ideal market. He is going to have to make a choice. He's going to have to make some level of compromise. There's no situation where he's going to have everything. And we go back through LeBron's history. In recent years, he has pretty much had his cake and eaten it too more than any other NBA player. The first time he went to Miami, then he goes back to Cleveland. He was able to instantly rearrange those pieces and set himself up. I think that just comes with age. I mean, I don't think he's past his prime, but I don't think you're in the same situation as a building block when you're 32, 33, as you were, in your mid to late 20s or even 3 or 4 years ago.
Okay.
I think that there's going to be some choices coming, and I think ultimately his priorities are going to shift, and I think that's going to leave Cleveland on the outside looking in because they just don't have enough of these things to kind of keep him happy. If I'm LeBron, what is the motivation to go back there next year? If this is what your new life has become, I guess that's my question after 2 weeks.
Well, okay. Those are fair questions. I think you're underrating how crafty LeBron is. I mean, he is absolutely playing chess. And no one saw the Cleveland move coming, and a lot of things can happen between now and July. So I don't know how much he will have to sacrifice, but you're right to raise the possibility that he's going to be in a situation where like there are no perfect options.
Andrew, if he's playing chess, though, he's got an awful lot of pawns lined up. I mean, this guy's
currently
this guy's short on rooks and bishops. I don't know, like D Rose, D Wade.
My point is. not only is it too early to write off the Cavs, it's way too early to lament LeBron's lack of options in free agency. So just chill on that front. I take issue with you pretending that we all knew that the Cavs were going to struggle like this.
We did.
No, we didn't. You didn't even. We were talking about the Cavs leading into the season, and we were like, you know, they may be kind of interesting. Like, we'll see how it goes. I think that was all I'm saying is what's remarkable about the beginning of the year is how many smart people looked at that Cleveland roster and were like, you know, a lot of this doesn't make sense, but it will probably work out just fine. And if you're lying, if
it probably
think that
will
didn't happen.
Well, first of all, you're rewriting history because I did not say those things. I said it was going to be choppy early until they got Isaiah back. I still hold by that. I think they're going to be the best team in the East when it all shakes out. I still hold by that. Okay. I think the one thing that we can look at here, the most interesting angle of this season for Cleveland becomes, do you cash in that Nets pick, right? I mean, do you feel everything closing in on you enough where you look at your rotation and say, we don't have five guys we can throw out there against Golden State in a quality lineup?
Yeah, and the answer to that is no. They're not trading that until June when they know what it's worth and how realistic it might be for LeBron to stay in July. And I think that's where I think it's too early to even like talk about his options in free agency because we don't know what trade targets there will be. We don't know where that Nets pick will land. And like, there's just a lot of different factors that have to play out before we say what's possible. And we should be very clear on the record that LeBron is going to the San Antonio Spurs next summer.
I love it.
That's our official pod stance. But can I just say, I put down a couple reasons why the Cavs shouldn't be nervous and a couple reasons why they should be nervous. Can I read those?
Please do.
All right. So the two obvious ones, reasons they shouldn't be nervous. It's October and there's another 7 months that need to play out here. Also, we've done this with LeBron every single year for the last 5 years. And I think by this point, I don't know anybody who has the energy to like sincerely concern troll over LeBron after the last few years, even if it's more warranted now.
Hold on 1 second, because I think the listeners are going to notice this too. Okay, I mentioned your first two reasons, and you argued against both of those reasons
when
I mentioned them earlier.
All I'm arguing against, you overstated them to an irrational degree. The other three, though, are J.R. Smith is not going to be this awful on defense when it matters, and Tristan Thompson can't possibly play worse than he looks right now. And those are two guys who I think could help change the equation a month or two from now. And if Isaiah Thomas comes back healthy, he is going to come back in a contract year straight murdering people. So like, I think Isaiah really could be what they need to sort of like inject some life into this season, because you're right. It's not just that they're losing. It's that like every game is just pretty brutal. Like I watched them against the Nets and it's just the lineups out there, like Rose, Wade, I don't think was playing that night, but like Rose, Jeff Green, Iman Shumpert, like a lot of these guys are not only past their prime, but like two or three years past the point where they were useful. And speaking of which, it's a good transition. Reasons the Cavs should be nervous.
Well, hold on 1 second. I have one more reason why they should not be nervous. They did beat Milwaukee head to head.
Okay.
And I think Milwaukee is in position, you know, as a potential Eastern Conference finalist team. They handled Giannis pretty well, I would say. I mean, no one's really stopping him. But LeBron kind of paced himself, took over when it mattered. And so they have some level of switch to flip.
Okay, and another reason that they shouldn't be nervous is that there will be room. If things get really dire, there will be room to make a trade, like midway through the year. And they could also make a coaching change. Who knows? But three reasons they should be nervous. Isaiah really might not be healthy this year. So if I were them, I would not be counting on him. And given the history of hip injuries, like, it's just a complete wild card. And the rest of the team just feels like every old ass team that has been brutal over the last like 15, like they feel like the Brooklyn Nets right now. And that's a real bummer and does not, I mean, LeBron can only do so much. And that's the last point, is that not only is this asking more of LeBron than we have in the past, but he has kind of been crappy to start the year. Like the defensive effort isn't really there and he looks a little sluggish. And this is another thing where we've, over the last couple of years, like LeBron always has these months where he doesn't look like, he just lacks that like pop, and then he takes a 2-week vacation to Miami and it works out. But like at some point, he's gonna start slowing down, and I don't want to be the one who wonders about that now. But it's at least something that I would think about, or it's something that I think about watching the Cavs, whether it's smart or not.
Yeah, I think another reason not to panic is you look at the rest of the Eastern Conference and teams like Detroit and Orlando.
Let's not kid ourselves.
Are at the top of the standings right now, right? So if you don't think LeBron can turn it on to beat Detroit or Orlando in a playoff series, I don't know what to tell you. I think some of this stuff for sure that you were mentioning would fall into the category of short-term overreaction. But I think the real takeaway here is don't be panicking about how they look on defense in October. Be panicking about where this is heading, or like at least be aware of where this is heading, because
be worried that they don't have many guys who ever projected to be useful on defense. I mean, like Jay Crowder is one guy who's not playing as well as they would have hoped, and maybe he can sort of like get in shape, get in rhythm, and be a different player in December. J.R. Smith, Tristan Thompson, sure. But like Dwayne Wade was always going to be a serious minus. And Derrick Rose, the same deal. Jeff Green, the same deal. Kevin Love, the same deal. Like, I don't know, man. Like, it's hard to patch things up when half the team like just doesn't play defense.
Yeah, and I think some of that's going to come back. I mean, I think guys like Crowder and Smith, like you mentioned, even Thompson, like they can't play worse, so they're starting slow. LeBron will certainly turn it up himself. I mean, he has been on complete cruise control. The people who were trying to float him as an MVP candidate disappeared pretty quick, didn't they? I mean, I haven't heard any of that talk.
Yeah, it's not great. Well, I feel like they're probably every basketball podcast is going to do a Cavs panic segment. So I think we fulfilled our duty there.
Well, what I tried to do is take it another degree, because I'm saying don't just panic about right now how ugly it is. Panic about how it's going to be 10 times uglier next season when LeBron's gone. So I think
managed to
keep it in the long-term perspective.
You also managed to weave in Sex and the City somehow, which you kind of lost me there, but I'm glad it happened. But we should move on to the other side of the country, to the Golden State Warriors. Now, this is one where, like, I refuse to take the bait and try
Thank
to control over what's happening in Golden State. The Warriors would have to lose like 35 games for me to start wondering about how they might look in the playoffs. But two questions after the Wizards. We got a lot of follow-ups to the Wizards-Warriors fight. First, Hucky Ducky says, give us Warriors fans who love the pod your real take on the Draymond face grab / pull down. And then EGR says, can you please explain how Kelly Oubre did not get tossed during the fight review and avoided a suspension? He got fined less than Dre. I don't know, man. I think that the Warriors, I like the Warriors. I like the Warriors fans. I love Draymond Green. But everybody needs to stop playing the victim on this, okay? Because Draymond came out in the media talking like he was completely blameless for the Beal incident. And I just don't buy it. I really, like, if you go, like, Draymond is never blameless. Draymond, at best, is, like, 30% to blame, probably closer to 40. Like, even just the stuff he says to guys during games, I know for a fact he says, like, some crazy shit to various opponents. And I don't know for a fact that that's what happened with Beal, but, like, they were going back and forth the entire half. Draymond elbowed him in the chest. Things escalated. it's not a big deal, and Beal was in the wrong. I just am kind of annoyed by how, like, Golden State Nation here has mobilized to, one, target Oubre, who, like, was kind of, it was clearly, like, ready to fight and was flailing around like an idiot, but didn't actually hit anyone and didn't need to get suspended. And then the idea that Draymond is somehow a victim again, like, that is kind of BS to me.
Yeah, I could see you trying to deflect this onto the Warriors fans, because what really happened was last week I explained to you why the Wizards are the type of team that constantly leaves you mortified and wanting to escape. And the very next night, you guys get into the lamest possible fight. Brad and Kelly getting into scraps.
Can I ask you why it's lame, though?
Well, first of all, there was no reason for Beal to do any of it. Second of all, they just kind of square up and grab each other's jerseys. What's the point of that? And then third of all, everyone runs around like a chicken with his head cut off and half your bench empties but does nothing. Right.
So, okay. But there are people who are out there claiming that, like, the Wizards, oh, this team talks tough, never backs it up. Like, I could understand you saying that if Beal had, like, picked on Lonzo, who's like 160 pounds. Beal went after Draymond. Like, that's like
Andrew,
the number
you,
one
you guys
bully.
You guys wore all black last year, and then you got eliminated by Kelly Olynyk. That's why people think you talk trash and don't back it up. It's as simple as that. And like I said, the very next night, after I said how embarrassing you guys were, you respond to that fight by blowing like a 17-point lead. I mean, come on. You have to be able to, like, separate yourself.
We were out there with John Wall and, like, Kelly Oubre and Tim Frazier and Mike Scott. Like, it was basically Wall and Otto against the world. You take Beal off the Wizards roster and they are kind of screwed. You take Draymond off the Warriors roster and they still have three Hall of Famers. So,
well, that's why you don't talk. That's why you don't punch Draymond in the face for no reason, because you're thin. You got to be better than that. I mean, that's an obvious one for Bradley Beal, and he admitted it, and I thought he handled the aftermath pretty well.
He did.
But this
and
is why people are calling you out, Andrew. Come on.
No.
Come on. You could see it. You could see it. You have to be self-aware enough to see it.
I am absolutely self-aware enough to see where the Wizards have left themselves open to ridicule. The Celtics series in particular was really not a good look, and it's going to be tough to come back from that. They're gonna have to answer that in the playoffs. But as far, like, do you at least see what I'm saying, where, like, Draymond's overdoing it a little bit on the whole victim angle? Because look, I refuse to believe that he was blameless for what happened. And
Draymond's on 11 about everything. Like, that's just how he is. I don't think we need to nitpick his little statements about a fight. He didn't do anything, like, massively wrong. Maybe there was a slight elbow in there, like you're mentioning. I don't necessarily remember it. I think that they're worried, the Warriors in general, they're worried about another suspension in the finals, right? And they're worried that Draymond's on some super secret Kiki Vandeweghe, like, blacklist, where anytime Draymond's involved in something, it's automatically going to get, like, twice or three times the punishment as another random player because he's a repeat offender, right? I think that's what they're worried about. And so I think they're trying to lay the groundwork here early, not necessarily that, like, everyone's out to get us, but more treat Draymond like any other random player that you would treat. You know what I mean? Because that is a real concern. If there's any way for them to lose the finals this year or lose a series in the playoffs this year, it's Draymond taking something a little bit further than he should and randomly getting suspended for a game, and that being a momentum changer, right? Like, that is one of the weakest points on their entire team, is if Draymond's out.
Yes, Draymond and Steph are the two most important players on their team, and they cannot win. I'm convinced they can't win without both of them healthy and out there through the playoffs. But I have to stop you, because the idea that Draymond is treated more favorably than other players. You realize that, right?
Go ahead and explain it.
Like, he spends the entire game not only talking to the refs, but fucking screaming at the refs. And again, this is coming from a place of love with Draymond. He's my guy. I have adored him since before the first title. But the idea that he is somehow treated unfairly, like, I've never seen anyone yell at refs more than Draymond Green, and I'm sure he has reasonable complaints a lot of the time, but, like, he does a lot of stuff where I'm like, wow, I can't believe he's not getting teed up here. So he's just a guy who lives in the gray area, and that's part of, like, that's what makes him great, and that is going to make him a target of the NBA every now and then, because that's like, it comes with the territory. So don't then turn around and act like he's just this like misunderstood figure. Like, I think everybody understands Draymond.
So what is the solution here? Are you calling on the NBA to tee him up every time he yells at a referee until he stops? I mean, is that what you're hoping for?
No, the solution is to stop playing the victim. Golden State fans, like, everybody should go read the, it's on like Anthony Slater's Twitter feed. Chris Haynes wrote a story about it. Draymond went on like a 3-minute rant about how the NBA has just been targeting him for like 3 years now, and it's kind of bullshit. Like, I'm sorry, like, Draymond has earned a lot of the attention that he's gotten. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, I think he might know it's BS too. Okay. I think he might be in on it. I kind of think there's a little bit of Draymond that's like, and I am not one of these guys who likes wrestling in any way. Like, you could make a wrestling reference, I would have no idea what you're talking about.
Me neither, actually.
I think he likes to play into it. I just think that he thinks being the bad guy is a good story, and people will talk about it, and it gives you know, something about their team that we can all kind of latch onto and get through this season, right?
That's,
I think,
fair.
That they want to constantly have a narrative, and I think he's looking for sources of motivation. I think this is clearly one that's probably going to drive him here for a while going forward. And we'll see if it's a distraction, which in the past, like, that's been a problem for him. You know, he's gotten so caught up in these little petty things that he loses his focus. He's even admitted to that. We'll see if it becomes a distraction or a motivation. My guess is it will be a motivation.
Well, and the Beal fight will be a big story headed into the finals in June when it's Wizards Warriors. So we all have that to look forward to. But for now, let's move from the Warriors and Cavs to the real champions of the first couple weeks here. Tanner says, I'm a longtime listener of the pod living in Austin, Texas, a well-deserved 5-star podcast. But please, enough about Lonzo, the miserable Suns, or the wonder that is Giannis. I grew up in Orlando, and I'm one of 7 Orlando Magic fans on Earth. What do the Magic need to do to earn some respect in the eyes of the league and reporters? Or if you were Orlando's GM, what moves would you be looking to make from here? What do you think, Ben?
How many of their games have you watched this year? Because I've watched, I think, 3. And the one that really stands out to me was when they just beat the mess out of the Spurs. And the funniest part about that game to me was their announcers who... Yeah. Like, this, I mean, to me, this should have been like their Super Bowl like victory parade, right? How often are you going to have a 30-point lead like going into the final minutes of the fourth quarter against the Spurs? Like, it barely ever happens. I looked it up. They've had like maybe 10 like truly ugly losses during the entire Greg Popovich era, and they were kind of threatening to make it like 30 or 35. And their announcing crew was just like, and Eric Gordon passes the ball to Terrence Ross. Like, you would have had no idea like where this moment stood in recent Orlando Magic history if you had just watched that game. So I guess on one hand, it's sort of a tribute to their commentary crew's professionalism. But on the other hand, like, for the Magic fans out there who are like upset about not getting any attention and respect, like, they're probably looking for it from us because their homer crew isn't really being homers, you know?
Yeah, I've watched that Spurs game on the Spurs feed, though. And the Spurs announcers were very much like, they kind of just checked out and stopped taking it seriously in the second half. They were pretty baffled throughout the first half. And it's tough because, to be honest with you, for the first couple of games, I was just seeing Magic scores and being like, well, what the hell happened there? Like, how are the Magic winning? And then I finally, like, Magic Spurs was appointment television for me, and it was such a blowout that I am like reluctant to read anything into it. But they actually look good, like via the highlights I've seen, via the numbers I've seen. Aaron Gordon at the four, finally, it should not have taken 3 years to put him at the four, but he's there, so that's a win. I think like Vucevic to me is probably the biggest X factor for them. Like if he can keep playing like this all year, they can probably make a run at the playoffs. They still, I think taking Elfrid Payton off the court also makes them a little bit more dangerous. Although DJ Augustine was 0-for-7 in a loss to the Hornets last night. So he's probably not the solution either, but like they are remarkably decent right now.
Yeah, I mean, some of it is coming from they figured things out down the stretch last year about how to play, right? So
yeah,
they are not bothering with the slow, ugly stuff they started last season with. It's a lot more spread out. They've had a couple of really, really impressive shooting nights from deep. You expect that will probably even out as the season goes. They're going to come back to earth a little bit. And they're also playing just super-duper fast. And I think early in the season, I mean, most of their rotation is young. Most of those guys are back from last year. They kind of have a certain level of continuity. This is the type of team that you would hope, and I'm sure they hoped, would get off to a quick start because they didn't really blow things up over the summer. And most of their guys are, you know, like 27 and under or so. So I think that they're the type of team where you could fall into the trap on them a little bit, you know, the positive, optimistic trap, and say, okay, well, once everybody else is totally in shape and prepared for how they're going to try to play, and once the talent kind of levels out, you know, they're probably going to come back to earth a little bit. So I hate to rain on their parade because I was accusing their own announcers of kind of like raining on their big parade. But the positive takeaways are they're a lot more fun to watch. They're a lot more entertaining. They're playing a smarter brand of basketball, which is always good. I guess I still have just kind of a basic level question about like, do they have enough talent? You know, do they have enough guys? Yeah.
Not only that, I think there are still some guys in there. Like, I don't think that Elfrid Payton is the long-term answer at point guard. I don't think that Terrence Ross is fine if he's a rotation player, but they're relying on him a little bit more than you would want. I do want to say though, like, a couple podcasts ago, we were talking about the Suns, and I said that the Suns and the Magic are two teams that for the last like 5 or 6 years have just had no plan whatsoever and really no idea what they're doing. And a couple people have emailed being like, well, look at the Magic now. And the Magic are under new management now. And John Hammond is in charge. I think they got the president of the Raptors to come down there, right?
They did, yeah.
Yeah, so like they are just like Jonathan Isaac, I think, has as high a ceiling as almost anyone in the draft and will be great defensively regardless, and will fit really well with where the league is going. Jonathan Simmons was an awesome signing. So I don't know. I like the direction of their team a lot more than I would have, like, if you'd asked me 9 months ago. And in the meantime, guys like Vucevic, who is probably not a long-term answer himself, like those guys playing well is really fun for Magic fans who have had 6 or 7 years of misery post Dwight. And then also just like, I think the NBA is more fun with a couple of these teams who are just sort of in the mix and making it interesting on a night-to-night basis, at least in the first month.
Yeah, a couple of things. First of all, I wouldn't necessarily give the credit for the start to the new management team.
No.
Because basically all the players who are playing well were acquired under the Hennigan era. But in terms of
Simmons and Isaac, though, are both new additions.
Yeah, but like when you look at Vucevic like coming into his own, I mean, this is sort of when you would expect to sort of him to turn a corner in terms of his career, right? Like he's in his prime. Aaron Gordon, I mean, that was a draft pick, you know, that they had made years ago. He is sort of right on schedule where you think he's going to be an impact type player. I mean,
they're not trying to play him at small forward anymore, which I think probably
they didn't down the stretch of last season either. They figured that out after the trade, right? And so I guess what I'm saying is, you can't just say, oh, this was like an overhaul job. You know, they didn't even change the coach when they got hired this summer. I mean, I think that you can mostly say that they had a careful offseason, the new regime. I mean, they didn't really shake things up that crazy. I think they're trying to evaluate who's keepers and who's not. But what I would say to push back against some of the critics of you, who are saying, oh, like, you know, they don't have a plan. You know, you are right. they had too many plans almost. It wasn't like they had zero plans, but like the whole Ibaka detour, like that was a serious plan. Like they really had committed to a certain style, which was a completely a wrong decision. And that past ownership group has to own that one. And that's why he's no longer there. You know, I mean, they changed course multiple times. And so, you know, maybe a better way to say what you had said on the previous podcast, rather than having no plan, was having lots of bad plans or too many bad plans in short success. But there was just no
coherent logic to what they were trying to do. And what I'm saying now is that there are some guys who are going to make this like entertaining in the meantime. And then long term, like if you're selling me on building around Isaac and Jonathan Simmons and like a couple like just smart free agents and draft picks, like that makes sense to me. And Hammond has proven that he can do that. So it'll be fun to see where this goes, which is the first thing, if the first time fun and the Orlando Magic have been in the same sentence in like forever.
Yeah, I guess my fun with the Magic is more about stylistic. Like they kind of, you know, figured out the big picture questions that they were struggling with. You know, they wanted to zag when everyone else is zigging. Now they're just going to zig with everyone else. I think that makes them more fun than any of the individual pieces that they have. Although I do really like Aaron Gordon. It's good to see him off to a pretty good start.
It really is fun to have him back, like, and relevant again. AJ asks, I know it's relatively early, but looking back on the summer, do you think we prematurely ridiculed the Pacers and Bulls for their trades?
I'm glad you asked this question, because in contrast to my impression of the Magic announcers sort of like, you know, being golf announcers during the biggest win of the season, you heard the Pacers announcers the other night, right? When Oladipo hits the game-winning shot and Sabonis has the best game of his career, goes 9-for-9 from the field. I'm sure you can imagine how the Pacers announcers were framing the Paul George trade in the middle of a game that saw Oladipo, you know, hit this crazy step-back three to win it, and the great game of Sabonis' life. Let's just say they were beating their chests, incredibly convinced that this was all the proof that you would need, that Kevin Pritchard, you know, won the trade. I also saw some tweets, you know, don't listen to the national media. You know, like they don't know what they're talking about.
Exactly.
Indiana won it.
What's your response? You are the national media. I think you and I were pretty hard on both of these teams.
For sure. I think my response, first of all, would be that Paul George has not hit the ground running in Oklahoma City. I had real concerns about that the whole way through, and I still have those concerns. I don't know how great of a fit that is for him. To me, I could see that lingering and him becoming a trade piece by the deadline. I'm not sure if anyone else, I might be the only person left believing that, but I don't know. The fit side on that side is not doing him the types of favors that guys like Oladipo and Sabonis, who are really set up to flourish because there's no expectations and they have as many minutes and touches as they want.
Really anyone else in Indiana, so.
Exactly. And so that's why they're kind of set up for success. In terms of, you know, the ceiling for the Pacers this year, I mean, I think they will be worse this year than they were last year. That's my, you know, my gut reaction. Much like Orlando, you know, they're coming out of the gate playing very fast, not quite top five pace, but very close. And I will say the most impressive thing about the Pacers is that they've done that, because Nate McMillan really cultivated his reputation as a coach by playing super slow, deliberate, isolation-heavy basketball in Portland. He just basically gave Brandon Roy the ball and said, it doesn't matter how many knee surgeries you've had, we're going to just trust you to do everything. And it really worked great for him. Like they had, I believe one year, they had a more efficient offense even than the 7 seconds or less Suns. So this is a complete departure from who he was like 5, 6, 7 years ago. And a lot of coaches struggle to make that sort of transition. So, you know, give them credit. But again, you've got a young team playing super fast, catching teams off guard early in the season. Does their talent level, where you look at that roster, I mean, Oladipo, he's not a star level player, right? I don't think we see anyone else on their
like
team.
It right now. He's, yeah, I think
do you believe that though? Do you really believe that?
No, absolutely not. But I do think that you came very close to hitting on the real takeaway from the first 3 weeks of action with both Paul George and Oladipo and Sabonis. Like, it's not an accident that Paul George has started slow and had trouble finding a rhythm next to Russell Westbrook. And it's not an accident that Oladipo and Sabonis suddenly are moving the ball and finding that basketball is a lot easier without someone dribbling for like 18 seconds of the shot clock and then passing you, or then basically bailing himself out with a pass with like 3 seconds on the shot clock. That I watched that happen to Oladipo like five times a game last year. And I've watched Thunder games where I'm like, why hasn't Paul George touched the ball in the last 4 minutes? And so I think that the real loser of this question is not us, but it might be Russell Westbrook.
Well, it might be you, because you sound like you're getting dangerously close to saying that Westbrook doesn't make his teammates better. And wouldn't you consider that a very important part of value? Like, if we were sitting over here assessing who was the most valuable player from last year, and we were looking at the most valuable and really emphasizing value and making teammates better and having an efficient offense where everybody benefits, you couldn't reach the conclusion that Westbrook was the MVP last year if you're thinking like that, would you?
Look, man, I'm not going to get back into this. I said all along, I've recognized Russ's flaws, and last year was just the story of the season was Russ. I wasn't going to deny it just to prove a point, okay? The story of the season was what it was. He deserved to win MVP, but he does have flaws, and I think we're seeing how Sabonis and Oladipo, with a little bit more room to operate and room to breathe in Indiana, are actually better than we thought. So that's a fair point. I will say, as far as the trades are concerned, the reason I didn't like that trade for the Pacers is that it, like, with a guy like Paul George, I don't really understand why you would go for players who are going to keep you in the middle of the pack. I think it would be healthier for them to have dealt him for a Brooklyn pick in February.
I think the reason why you saw that was after Oladipo hit that three-pointer and he was like, this is my city, and it was like the Kmart or like the outlet store version of when Steph did that a few years ago, you know, like tapping his chest and like pointing at the ground. Like, that's what they wanted, you know? They wanted to have somebody who actually wanted to be in Indiana, who was happy to be there, who'd been to college there, that the fan base could relate to, that would just keep the building full. I mean, they love basketball there. They want to have a certain level of respect, and I think their choice was, can we be respectable with Oladipo in a best-case scenario? And I'm sure they concluded yes, and a lot of us concluded no, and I think the jury's still out on that. I mean, we don't know exactly
we'll see
how respectable they'll be. But if they're close to 500 and Oladipo's out there giving you, you know, a show every few nights, you know, there are worse fates. And if we want to talk about worse fates, we should talk about the Bulls, because that was the other team you wanted to mention, right?
Yeah.
I don't know. How can we walk back anything we said about the Bulls when they have the worst offense in the entire NBA under guru Fred Hoiberg? They're dead last. They're even worse than the Lakers, who have been pretty rough. You know, Lonzo is kind of dragging down their offensive efficiency a little bit, because he can't hit a shot. They're worse than the Suns, who got their coach fired. They were in a mutiny. They're worse than the Kings, who I think got doubled up over the first quarter against the Wizards the other night. I mean, they're worse than everybody on offense. So why are we going to reanalyze the Bulls-Timberwolves trade?
I mean, Lowry has been that good. Have you not seen our guy? Like, he might be... Hold on.
Did Jimmy Butler have to die for this?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think a lot of people were mocking the Bulls in part because of Lowry. And they were like, wow, they just took this 7-foot soft stiff and he's going to wilt away. And this was all just a complete waste of time from Gar and Pax, who, by the way, have made so many other reprehensible decisions over the last 4 years that it's possible for them to have not completely botched this situation or gotten lucky with Lowry and still be like the worst management team in the NBA. But I do think that like Lowry is good enough that whatever, like if you get another franchise guy out of the Jimmy trade, that's the goal. And I don't know. I don't want to give them too much credit because all of this
sounds like you're calling Markkanen a franchise guy, really?
No, part of it is my own regret because I fell prey to groupthink as the draft process unfolded. Like if you go back midway through the year and even towards the end of the year, I was watching Arizona games and being like, Lauri Markkanen is probably the best shooter in the country. And he's 7 feet tall, and there's no way he's not going to be good in the NBA. And then a lot of people started nitpicking his defensive rebounding and his defense and his offensive rebounding. And we're basically just saying, like, this guy is Channing Frye. And eventually I came around and sold my Markkanen stock before the draft, and I feel like an idiot now. And so I just have really enjoyed watching him look pretty good through the first couple weeks. And I think that there's reason for hope, which is really all the Bulls were looking for. And if Markkanen is pretty good and they lose 65 games, like that's kind of a successful year if you're a Bulls fan right now.
Okay, I guess what is it that you're seeing him doing so that he looks pretty good that you didn't expect? Because, you know, I'm seeing the shooting numbers for sure. Like, they pop, especially for a young guy, especially for a young seven-footer. You know, he's not really a presence on the offensive glass.
No, but his defensive rebounding.
He's not playmaking.
He's rebounding more than people expected him to. And that was the fear with him was that he was going to be a seven-foot guy who would get you, like, three rebounds a game and just stand outside and take threes. And he's not getting overpowered as much as I think some people feared he would.
Yeah, because he's not really getting the defensive stats. He's not really doing anything besides shoot. So it kind of seems to me like maybe he's delivering on the pre-draft analysis faster than people expected. But
yeah,
and maybe rebounding a little bit more. But otherwise, is he doing anything else, or is that just kind of what he is?
Yeah, but if he is a dead-eye shooter like that for his entire career, like he's going to be a real factor for them, like an all-star level guy.
Whoa. Okay.
I mean, I'm just saying it's there's a chance that this is like a blind squirrel situation for the Bulls. Like they weren't going to do that much better with Jimmy, and the prospect of bringing him back for another 2 years and then paying him $250 million to be on an eighth seed was not like that, or not $250 million, $200 million to be on an eighth seed. Like that was not terribly attractive either.
I would guess that's better than having the worst offense in the NBA, knowing that Fred can't do his job. And are you going for the next 5 years? I mean,
I feel pretty gross defending the Bulls for any of this, so I'm not going to continue. But it does.
I don't know where you're at today. I don't know.
No, look, like rebuilding.
You read Big Head's marketing plan. You're all in.
No, rebuilding is better than just sort of like hanging around the middle and signing like unhelpful free agents every summer, and I think it would be the ideal scenario would be for the Bulls to somehow be bad enough to cost Gar and Pax their jobs so that someone else can lead the rebuild. And that's why I would be concerned if I were a Bulls fan with those guys in charge. But I do think that this is healthier than like running it back with Rondo and Jimmy Butler this year. That would have been even worse.
Well, Rondo was always a terrible idea. We said that from the start. How many games for Chicago do you think you're going to watch after January 1? Do you think you'll watch one of their games down the stretch?
Well, so it's tricky because I will never watch a full Bulls game this year, but I will.
Rebuilding is amazing, but I don't want any part of it. I'm not going to even pay attention to it. Yeah, okay.
If I were a Bulls fan, I would not want to watch Bulls games, and I would say, look, please go lose and get the number one pick, and let's start over. But I will watch, like, 10-minute increments of Lowry, and that's really all I can handle. And Chris Dunn is coming back healthy, so maybe he'll be decent. But that's all I've got for you as far as Bulls excitement. Moving on, though, three more questions. First, Lewis says, given Ben Simmons' start to the season, the numbers he's putting up, and the lack of all-star point guards in the East with Isaiah being on the sidelines, could Ben Simmons end up with an all-star spot in his rookie year? Give me your answer.
I think he's going to wind up being in contention for it. It's one of those things, though, where he'd almost be better off. You know, you're always banging on him about calling himself the point guard and how important that is. I never thought that mattered.
Right.
But he would be smarter to call himself a power forward, right? Because there'd be more spots for him to get into the All-Star game.
That's the thing. I don't really understand where Lewis is going here, because point guard is literally the only position where there's competition in the Eastern Conference. It's like Ben Simmons and Nick Batum and Kevin Love for like power forward.
Yeah, so I think he's going to be in the mix. And, you know, at some point, those final three spots are just wild card spots, you know, so it doesn't matter what position you go. I doubt Ben Simmons is going to be getting voted in by his peers and by fans to a starting spot, but I think he is going to be at worst an All-Star snub this year. But some of that is a reflection of the conference's talent, not just his own play.
Yeah, well, and his numbers are definitely going to be good enough to put him in the conversation, which itself is kind of a huge victory for the Sixers. And yeah, like he looked good against Dallas. He impressed Rick Carlisle. Rick Carlisle came out and said, "We knew he was going to be good, but we didn't have any idea that he'd be this good." And like, I don't think I've ever, Rick Carlisle says something that positive maybe like five times a year. So congrats to Ben Simmons for living up to the hype. I remain like quietly skeptical, but yo, Rick Carlisle isn't, so that's a win. Moving
on to, it
might
be the first nice thing that Rick Carlisle's ever said about a young player too.
Exactly. Like I was shocked when I read that. Moving on to the next question. Morgan says, "Longtime listener, I've recently started following Ben's Instagram and I appreciate all the Utah love. I know he's not Lonzo Ball, but how about some Donovan Mitchell love? At this point, he is what everyone thought Dennis Smith was supposed to be this year. He's crazy athletic, and he seems to have a pretty good sense of the game. What do you guys think?" I mean, this started over Summer League. Like, Donovan Mitchell is definitely probably the biggest surprise in this class. I think a lot of people expected him to be sort of a good two-way like role player type for Utah and maybe like a potential starter down the line, but like he's shown more ability as a scorer than anyone would have expected this early. He looked great over the weekend, and he's going to be pretty uneven all year. Like I wouldn't sign him as a fantasy free agent, because I think there are going to be a lot of nights where he goes like 2 of 9 for 6 points. But he has moments. It goes back to the conversation we had about Fultz last week. Like, he's one of those guys where you put him on the court and it's very clear that he belongs and that he can hang with whoever you put him out there with, athletically. And he just looks comfortable, and all of that stuff is really encouraging. And he just is like, he's a little craftier than I think I would have expected.
Yeah, I think he also benefits from the situation there in Utah, where what he brings to the table is needed so badly and it stands out so much compared to the other parts and their style of play, that when he goes up and catches that second chance dunk and he's like 2 feet off the court and, you know, his head's rim level, and you're looking around and you're thinking like, wow, Joe Ingles, I don't think he can do that. You know, I'm not sure he's gonna be able to do that.
He looks like a linebacker, and it's just a very different experience than what they went through with like Dante Exum, who showed up to the NBA looking like he was 15 years old. So like, Donovan Mitchell is definitely an upgrade in that department as well.
Yeah. And I just think also, you know, his energy. I mean, when I look at Utah, it's like they slowly strangle you to death. And like, here's this guy just like bouncing around, you know, just like, you know, everywhere. And so I think, you know, he really pops when you watch them. I mean, you definitely see him, you know, it's early, but they need him. I mean, that's a spot that they've needed for years. I mean, we've been praying and praying that, you know, one of those guys would step up for them. You know, I think he deserves to be mentioned here, but I also think, and I mentioned this last week, like there's so many rookies playing well. Like, he can play well and still not be one of the top five guys that we talk about. Like, I don't think we're slighting Donovan Mitchell by not leading podcasts with him, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. That's why he's at like the hour mark and not the 10 minute mark. The only other thing I would like to say is that I have yet to see Donovan Mitchell play well and not wonder about what might have happened had the Nuggets just stayed at that spot and taken him. Because, like, the Nuggets deal trade, I think it, this was like they were either at 13 or 14 and had a chance to draft Mitchell and flipped the pick for Trey Lyles and Tyler Lydon, and neither of whom look like they're going to contribute at any point in Denver, really. And it just, that's one of those things where, like, you, it's very difficult to contend in the West. And if you make one mistake, it can kind of haunt you. And that might be a mistake that haunts them.
Yeah, or not trading for Eric Bledsoe. I mean, that could haunt them too.
Well, even
still,
if you,
waiting,
if you had
still waiting.
if you had Donovan Mitchell, you could trade him for Eric Bledsoe, and like that's the value of keeping guys like that. But so it goes. I don't think they're going to be able to convince Phoenix to take Tyler Lydon and Trey Lyles for Bledsoe, but Mitchell might have. Last question. I like how you David says. I like how you guys compared Reggie Jackson to a dental drill. Very apt. You should take this a step further and call him Root Canal Reggie from now on. That's a fantastic nickname, and I am all for it. The Reggie Jackson experience, you mentioned it earlier, the Pistons, kind of decent. I mean, did you watch the Warriors game last night?
Yeah, I've watched them a couple times. Again, it's a team I think that's really benefiting from the continuity factor. Like, I don't think Reggie's even necessarily back to where he was 2 years ago. Finishing still kind of questionable. But those guys are playing sort of like a team. I think they've been able to get Bradley into what they're trying to do, you know, fairly well. And they've hit the ground running early in the season. But nevertheless, Reggie, I mean, some of the things that he does are just so frustrating. I mean, late in that Warriors game, he threw like an alley-oop to Drummond, just like flippantly chucked it up there, and there wasn't very much time left in the game. And it was just like, you just slap your head when you watch this guy play.
Dude, all right, so we talked about Reggie like maybe probably two weeks ago. And I had said, look, I don't totally understand why the entire league hates this guy. And then maybe a night or two later, I went to the Wizards-Pistons game and watched Reggie Jackson for about 48 minutes. And now I get it, because he sort of behaves like Patrick Beverley, except that like he's more entitled than Patrick Beverley. So like he talks trash to the other team the entire game. And annoys the hell out of, like, he annoyed the hell out of Wall, Beal, like, basically, like, half, every Wizards guard hated Reggie Jackson by the end of the game. But then he also was just, like, half-assing it on offense and made all kinds of dumb mistakes, so that I think his teammates were pretty worn out. And then after the game, the Pistons had gone on a little run in the fourth quarter, and Reggie Jackson came out and said, we were finally allowed to play basketball. And it was one of those things where, like, he was talking about the refs, but, like, it was sort of misconstrued. And I can understand why other teammates would be, like, a little miffed. The bottom line is, he just has a gift for antagonizing everyone in his midst. And I didn't really appreciate it until seeing it in real time.
And then I sent you that video clip the other night, which I'm sure really underscored it, because they were in like a 2 or 3 possession game, final minute of the game. And I'm just going to paint this as best I can. I wish it was a visual podcast sometimes, but the ball goes to Reggie at the top of the key, and there's like 6 seconds left on the shot clock. And for whatever reason, this broadcast happened to do like the blinking shot clock once it gets to 5. So it kind of feels like you're in like that TV show 24 or whatever, where you're like dismantling a bomb, because it's like 5, 4, 3, 2. And so this like visual effect is just going crazy in the bottom right-hand corner of the screen. Meanwhile, Reggie is just nonchalantly dribbling the ball like 2 steps behind the three-pointer. The clock's winding down. Defenders are all over him. He's not trying to come up with a backup plan. He's not trying to draw a foul. He's not trying to put his head down and go to the basket. He's not doing anything except for dancing with the basketball in this incredibly important possession as the clock runs out. He finally realizes the clock's about to run out with 1 second left on the clock, so he takes a dribble towards the hoop. It goes off. He waits like a full second and a half, and then he underhand scoops the ball so it basically hits the top of the shot clock. And then he turns around after all of this, after this completely blown possession where like his court awareness is completely exposed, it's non-existent. He turns around and he's just like chuckling and laughing like, oh, ha, ha, my bad, guys. Just like, this is not who you want to go to war with.
Was,
I'm sorry.
It was in the final 2 minutes of the game. Like, that was the most amazing part. As I looked down, I was like, oh my God, that's the fourth quarter. That was the ultimate root canal Reggie moment. And that's the half-assed approach that I was talking about. Like, he has a couple of those moments each quarter. And yet, the Pistons beat the Warriors Sunday night. And they look like reasonably okay. Tobias Harris is playing well. Andre Drummond is making his free throws and has been pretty productive. They beat the Clippers on Saturday night. I mean, I don't know. Maybe they're okay. Maybe root canal Reggie is the answer in Detroit. But that, I don't know.
But
I think,
but even if he's the answer, they can't get fans to show up at their home games, even though they have the brand new stadium. And you can't convince me anyone's buying a Reggie Jackson jersey. So where is this going? I think that's one of my questions is like,
honestly,
how
though,
high do they have to overperform expectations before people give him a chance? That's what I want to know.
After the sequence you sent me the other night, I considered buying a Reggie Jackson jersey. Root canal Reggie. In root canal we trust. Anyways, all right, you have to go. You're going to Clippers Warriors tonight. By the way, if the Warriors don't beat the Clippers, then we will have to talk about what's wrong with the Warriors.
Yes, we will. And there's nothing really wrong with the Warriors. We know that. But
yes.
Sure, we can pretend.
We'll have to go through the motions like the Warriors have been doing for the last 3 weeks. But until then, I will talk to you on Friday and have fun at the game tonight. 5-star reviews. Questions to openfloormail@gmail.com, and I'll talk to you soon, man.
Yeah, shout out Open Floor Globe. I love the listeners. I know you guys heard Andrew walk back his MVP pick today. He snuck that in there, but I know people who are paying attention heard that. 5-star reviews on Apple Podcasts. Andrew, I'll talk to you.
All right, man. Peace.
Another great edition of Open Floor is in the books. Did you know Locked On has a daily podcast for all 30 NBA teams? If you're a Lakers fan, search Locked On Lakers. A Celtics fan, search Locked On Celtics. Warriors fans, search Locked On Warriors. Yes, all 30 NBA teams have a daily bite-sized podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team.
It's the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.